Superhuman eyes. Accelerated evolution.
Imagine a world where food cravings are opportunities for deeper understanding and self-growth. Mindfulness as a transformative tool grounded in neuroscience is the realm of Dr. Judson Brewer, pioneer in habit change and self-mastery. Dr. Judson Brewer has spent over two decades blending mindfulness training with neuroscience, unraveling the brain's reward system and its role in addictions and anxiety. As Director of Research and Innovation at Brown University's Mindfulness Center and an Associate Professor in Behavioral and Social Sciences and Psychiatry at Brown Schools of Public Health and Medicine, his groundbreaking work has been globally recognized on platforms like TED and in publications like Time, The New York Times, and Forbes. In this episode, we explore Dr. Judd's latest book, The Hunger Habit: Why We Eat When We're Not Hungry and How to Stop. This book offers a profound exploration of how our brains and behaviors are intertwined with our eating habits. Dr. Judd's approach, rooted in neuroscience and mindfulness, provides a compassionate and practical guide to healing our relationship with food. Dr. Judd, welcome to the Superhumanize podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I am fascinated by your field of work, and it intersects with a lot of my personal practices and also some of the work I'm involved in. And your extensive research in the intersection of mindfulness, neuroscience, and habit change has really advanced our understanding of how to tackle addictions or anxiety. Your TED Talk on breaking bad habits has reached millions. So your work is literally leveling up, optimizing, helping many people, and especially many people who also suffer with these things. Can you share what initially drew you into the study of mindfulness and habit formation and the neural mechanisms behind it?
Yes, it started back in medical school for me when I realized I had no idea how my own mind worked and that I was pretty stressed out as a medical student. And long story short, started meditating, realized that it was really helpful, and then decided after about 8 years of practice, of meditation practice, to shift my career from studying molecular biology and mechanisms of change on a molecular level. I decided to shift that focus to studying mindfulness. And I remember when I was in residency, that's when I made the decision to shift. Somebody told me I was going to kill my career because it was in the land of unicorns and rainbows at the time, because there wasn't a lot of research done around it. Part of that shift also came from working with patients who were really struggling with addiction. And as when I was a newly minted psychiatrist, really struggling myself with helping them with addiction and more broadly with habit change, decided to bring together the struggles I was having clinically with my interest in understanding the mind and bring those together with regard to studying habit change and then seeing how I could apply that in the clinic.
I think it's really important to underscore what you also just said. At times where certain topics are not part of what's commonly agreed upon as scientific, you literally can kill your career. So you truly went out on a limb there, and it takes trailblazers such as yourself, I just want to acknowledge that, to really move things and move the needle. You've had a unique vantage point on the evolution of mindfulness and scientific research. How have you seen the perception of mindfulness change in the scientific community over the years?
Yeah, over the last couple of decades, it's been a really interesting journey that I've been fortunate enough to be part of and observer of as well. So when I first started, you know, in the field in the early aughts, there was very little published about mindfulness. I remember, especially with addictions, there was not a single randomized controlled trial published where mindfulness was tested as a primary treatment for addiction. So that's how nascent the field was. There were some hints of some signal from folks like Richie Davidson's lab, et cetera, who's a pioneer in the field, but not a lot that had been done. And to watch, to be starting research where you can basically ask any question and it hasn't been answered yet, which is pretty exciting. And rarely is there a field like that, to be then being able to help think through some of the basic mechanisms, observe what people are finding early on, get to come together at small conferences with some of the early pioneers and put our heads together and say, this isn't working. This isn't what this is. How does all of this fit? It's been a really exciting couple of decades, I'll put it that way. And I'll say that there's been a lot, even in the evolution of, so just understanding the mechanisms underlying mindfulness, but also in how people deliver it. Jon Kabat-Zinn was the pioneer of the mindfulness-based stress reduction program that he started back in the 1970s. And that program was largely unchanged, and still you can find it unchanged, delivered all over the world because it's one of the first evidence-based treatments. Yet it's delivered in person, 2.5-hour sessions, 8 weeks, plus an all-day retreat. And I've gotten to see how that has now, it's really interacted with the modern day where people are, he started this way before the internet was even developed. And so the internet has impacted how people learn, how they spend their time, and where they put their attention. And so I think it's been interesting to watch the evolution of the digital therapeutics. That term was only coined in, I think, 2017, where people could start to deliver treatments through apps. And we actually started testing mindfulness-based treatments for that early on. You know, to give you a long-winded answer to that question, there's been a huge amount of evolution and change. And I feel like it's still evolving as the modern day evolves. And it'll be really interesting to see how all of this comes together with AI as well.
Yes, I'm very excited for that. We really are living at a time where the convergence of these ancient wisdom and modern technology can bring forth tools that can absolutely revolutionize our lives and have. What do you foresee with the advance of AI and how it can be integrated into whether it's the science, the studies, the digital therapeutics, how do you see this moving forward?
My crystal ball is currently in the shop. It doesn't seem to work. And I think with AI in particular, it's so early days where, you know, the breakthroughs that had happened, say, in 2023 with just getting these conversational agents up and running as true conversational agents and totally tore through the Turing tests, like without fanfare. Oh, yeah, your heart can't distinguish this from a human. Oh, by the way, that was the prize, like for decades that people were trying to go for. And it just blew right through that. I think we're going to start to plateau out on, wow, conversational agents can basically reproduce human language and predict the next character is what they're doing. So what's out there on the internet, they can be trained on and are being trained on. So how that plays out with mindfulness training is going to be really interesting because they're, who knows how many books written about mindfulness and how many Reddit threads and how many videos and all of this. But it doesn't mean that all of them are accurate. And it also doesn't mean that all of them are optimized for the individual. And so here it will be really interesting to see how people are able to curate the material to get it accurate, because I've played with this myself, if you ask the current models, hey, tell me about mindfulness, teach me to meditate type of thing, it'll give a superficial answer that's not terrible, but it's not one that I would say, wow, that's great. I would use that as a way to train somebody in mindfulness. And moving from superficial Reddit scrapes or however they've trained their data to something truly meaningful and helpful is going to be the next step. And that's not as easy as just getting a larger LLM. That really takes some, you know, reinforcement learning through human feedback or other methodologies that people are starting to explore to really see how we can bring this human wisdom element in and deliver it. That's ultimately what it's about, is these pairing, optimizing what humans can do, optimizing the language models for what humans can't do, which is scale ourselves, for example. And I know some folks that are have meeting some early success, or at least they're reporting early success with being able to take at least well demarcated programs and saying, hey, I can actually deliver my program, for example, through an LLM when they give it boundaries and they give it good training. So I think that we're going to see more of that in the near term and in the long term. And then as the logic base gets improved in these general models, seeing that applied in the mindfulness field, so that the way I think of this is, if there's a teacher that's answering the same question 100 times, that's something that they could outsource to their bot, for example. Mm-hmm. But the interaction piece, where you're really having a teacher understand a student and help to draw out their experience so that the student knows what questions to ask, and then the teacher knows the nuanced answers, that's going to be farther off. Not impossible, but definitely, I don't see that happening in the next year.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm following all of the developments closely as well. I'm quite excited for the future and the possibilities. I'm a chronic optimist.
Yeah.
So I see more benefits coming from these advancements than negatives. At least that's my preference, to go through life.
I'm with you there. And I think I was really impressed with that. There was a short YouTube documentary, I think it was called AlphaGo or something, on the team of DeepMind when they were trying to beat the grandmaster of the game Go. And at the end of the movie, they talked about really bringing humans and AI together to enhance both. Because there are things that AI is probably never going to be able to do in our lifetimes. And there are things that humans will never evolve to do, which is doing a billion calculations in a second, that type of thing. And so where we can acknowledge our limitations, those types of calculations, we can then say, okay, I'm going to outsource that to a bot. And then that can help provide this supercharge for the human to say, okay, hey, answer this question or find this trend where I can't do that. But it can then feed back and say, and then give me that answer so that I can then use that information to augment my teaching or whatever, where a human might not have been able to do that otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And hopefully we won't create more habits. I'm just thinking, my mind went to this is a simple thing compared to what we're talking about, but these AI boyfriend, girlfriends, there's a particular platform I'm thinking of where people literally get addicted to communicating with that AI. Yes, but that's a completely different realm. A potential cause for anxiety, which you are also an expert in, and how to alleviate that. What, you wrote a best-selling book on the topic. I actually want to dive into your latest book, The Hunger Habit, Why We Eat When We're Not Hungry and How to Stop. You have quite a fresh perspective on this, and I would like to know your thoughts. You write about it in the book. How did we end up in this mess? Basically, you're discussing the complexity of our food habits and modern society. So how did we end up in this mess with regard to food?
Yeah. For anybody that's scientifically inclined, this is a fascinating story. And I'll give the high level. And I'm not going to dumb it down, but just to give some sense of how interesting this is. We have these survival mechanisms that are evolutionarily conserved all the way back to sea slugs, right? So very simple mechanisms that are really good at helping us remember things like where food is. That's how they originally evolved. And also helping us learn where danger is so we can avoid it. And these mechanisms, they're called positive and negative reinforcement, are still at play in modern day, yet it's less critical for us to have to go and forage for food because we know where our refrigerator is, right? We learn where it is, same mechanism, we learn it. But that opens up the opportunity for this mechanism to get co-opted by other things. So for example, we start to associate mood with food. So we learn to eat when during a celebration or when we're sad or mad or frustrated, or you name an emotion and somebody has associated it with eating. And the way that works is that, let's say that somebody is stressed, that, and they happen to eat some chocolate or a donut or some cake or some crisps or whatever, and they distract themselves for a moment, that actually taps into that same reinforcement learning mechanism that says, hey, when you're stressed, you should eat something because you'll feel better, right? At a very basic level, we just know I'd feel better, whether it's distraction, whether it's a dopamine hit from whatever the food it was that they ate or a combination. Either way, this sets up these habits for us to eat in the absence of hunger. And this is so prevalent in modern day that scientists have come up with a term, and I love it because it's a misnomer. It's called hedonic hunger. And it's a misnomer because it's there to highlight or to name or demarcate eating in the absence of hunger. So it's not actual hunger. Like the homeostatic hunger is different when it's our stomach is rumbling and we need the calories. This is truly just eating when we're sad or eating when we're celebrating or eating just out of a habit. And this can get in modern day has gotten totally, I'll say, weaponized by the food industry.
Yes.
Because they can engineer everything down to terms called like the bliss point and the vanishing caloric density. There are all these things that they can do to trick our bodies into wanting more. I'll summarize it this way. Somebody said it this way. They said tastes, they were talking about eating some type of artificial candy or something. They said, it tastes like more. Right? Because they couldn't even characterize it. Is it sweet? Is it? It's like, I just want more.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. This crisp, this chip that you eat and it tastes okay. And then it's something right after you swallow triggers you to, I need more.
Yeah.
This is really, there's plenty of recent studies that have highlighted the addictive nature of ultra processed foods. Yeah. And actually also drawing parallels to how the tobacco industry wants to minimize the addictiveness of their products. And which also has spurred discussions on the need for maybe policy actions to mitigate the public health implications. There's also, I think there was an article in the British Medical Journal on ultra-processed food addictions. And they also said, they suggested that reclassifying these foods as addictive could lead to regulatory measures similar to those that have been. How do you perceive the impact of these industry practices on food addiction and habits? And what do you think is most, because I think the numbers are quite staggering, right?
Yes.
If you look at studies, how addictions really get triggered by that, we're not talking about something that's just, yeah, it can happen. No, it's pervasive. What measures do you think are most critical in curbing these particular influences?
That's a great question. So just starting with the simple definition of addiction that I learned in residency, I think that'd be a good place to frame this. So I learned this definition, continued use despite adverse consequences. And it gets interesting. So with cigarettes, you can argue there's nothing healthy about smoking a cigarette. And so it's pretty straightforward, right? There's nothing healthy about using cocaine. Unless somebody's using it as a local anesthetic, which it is actually used for. So we can look at that definition and we can start asking this question. When somebody is eating or consuming a food-like substance, are there adverse consequences there? And so we can talk about the short-term and the long-term adverse health consequences that we're seeing more and more of with these hyper-processed food-like things. It's hard to even call them food.
Yes.
Because if you step back and you ask the question, does anybody ever get addicted to eating apples or whole food? No, they don't. right? And so you can even see these parallels with like cocaine. Cocaine's refined from coca leaves. Are coca leaves addictive? Apparently not. People can chew coca leaves. They're not going to get addicted to them. So if you take food sources that are natural, that are in their whole forms, it's a very different ballgame. We tend not to get addicted to eating. Think of it, the simple way to put it is like a whole food plant-based diet. I don't know anybody that's addicted to that. I can certainly say there are a lot of data suggesting that's very healthy for people. And so we could say, well, somebody's eating a whole food plant-based diet, continued use, despite actually good consequences. So it's the opposite of an addiction. So here I would say people can talk policy. And it's interesting to see how many people probably don't know, at least in the US, the tobacco industry, a lot of the companies merged with food companies when they were starting to run into regulatory issues with nicotine being addictive. And because they said, hey, we've got a bunch of engineers that can engineer products for consumption. Let's hire them to make food addictive. And we've seen the consequences of that, where despite the simple things that I learned in medical school, just make sure you have more calories out than calories in to not gain weight, we've watched the clinical obesity trends just skyrocket over the past number of decades. So we know what we're, quote unquote, supposed to do. The food industry is pretty clear on how they can get us to continue consuming. And so on one hand, there can be policy regulatory issues that people can go after. And certainly they're going to be fought by the lobbyists and the folks with the money. Anybody that's threatened, where their livelihood is threatened by that is going to fight back. Another, and so certainly worth doing. I'm not a policy person, so, you know, I certainly would support that, but can't go into the nuances of that. What I can say from an individual perspective is that the more we learn how our minds work, the more, no matter what the next addictive thing is that comes out, whether it's food or social media or AI or whatnot, if we can see where the potential for addiction comes from, then we can be more in control ourselves as individuals. So that's the place where I've been focusing most.
Yes, absolutely, Dr. Judd. And I think this is so important because this is empowering versus disempowering. While we may not be able to control our surroundings, our circumstances, what life puts in front of us, we can very well control how we perceive it, how we react to it. And I love this perspective. I love the tools that you are giving people to move beyond these cycles of addictions, feeling disempowered, and also the suffering that plainly comes with also food habits that are not serving us. The suffering can be immense, physically, emotionally, cognitively. You mentioned a little while ago, and I'd like to loop back to that. You also talk about it in the book, of course. You talk about identifying your urges. Is it hunger or something else? What strategies can people actually use to recognize whether their hunger is physical or it's something emotional, something tied to a certain habit, perhaps?
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, actually, between mood and hunger, where I'm sure people have heard the term hangry, you know, where we kind of, yes, where we tend to get irritable when we're hungry. And so there can be signs and symptoms, let's say, of that's unclear whether somebody's actually hungry or just irritable, for example, because it can be hard to concentrate when our stomach is empty. It can be hard to concentrate when we're really anxious. And those are very different things from a caloric standpoint. Mm-hmm. So here there are very few things that are in medicine they call pathognomonic, things that are like very specific to a certain thing. So one of those for homeostatic hunger, for true actual physiologic hunger, one marker is when our stomach is rumbling. Our stomach tends not to rumble unless somebody has some strange learned behavior. But our stomach tends not to rumble when we're sad, when we're anxious, when we're stressed, when we're lonely or whatnot. And we can also use just some common sense where we step back and ask, how long has it been since I've eaten? If it's hard to tell whether we're actually hungry or stressed or in some other mood funk. And I say that it's not always easy for folks to be able to identify this at the beginning. So the first step that I have people start with is just to recognize how these habits form so they can be on the lookout for them. And then it can be easier to just ask a simple question. Am I actually hungry or is this a habit? And really, it's about just taking that urge to eat and as they're reaching for food, asking this question, am I actually hungry or is this a habit? And checking to see when's the last time they ate. Has it been hours or minutes? Is their stomach rumbling or are they just bored or stressed or just looking for something to distract them from something else? And those can be signs that it's not actually hunger. It's something else that they're trying to distract themselves from. That simple question, am I hungry or is this a habit? And then also when they eat, this is where it gets really interesting from a neuroscience standpoint. When somebody eats, it boils down to stepping out of these old, I don't even know what to call them, these memes that we have or these assumptions that we have as a society that we just need to use our willpower to not do a behavior. So I can't tell you how many patients and people that I've met who have said, oh, I don't have enough willpower. And they've been trained societally that there's something wrong with them and they need to develop more willpower. And if they can just have that magic willpower, everything will be just fine. As a neuroscientist, I look at that and I ask the question, do you know that neuroscientists don't even talk about the term willpower? Like, it's not even in our equations for behavior formation and behavior change. So looking at this from a neuroscience standpoint, all the things I learned in medical school are a bit outdated, let's just put it that way, because they're not taking this neuroscience perspective. And so that next step, after recognizing whether somebody's actually hungry or not, is to check to see, you know, if they're trying, if let's say they're eating out of habit, instead of saying, don't do that, just stop it, I have them say, go for it, but pay attention as you do. And what that does is it taps into the direct mechanisms of change, which are predicated on how rewarding a behavior is. And so somebody eats, let's say overeating. We did a study, we published a study a couple of years ago where we had people pay attention as they overate. And they learned very quickly, meaning within 10 to 15 times of doing this, right? It doesn't take 10 years if they've had this habit for 10 years. It takes 10 times. What they realize very quickly is that overeating does not feel good. And anybody that's overeaten, you're nodding your head, anybody that's overeaten can think back to the last time they've overeaten and ask themselves, was that good? Did that actually work out well? Stomach ache tends not to be a sign of things going well, right? So our bodies actually tell us everything that we need to know. And what that's called in neuroscience terms is a negative prediction error, meaning that they have a habit of, say, overeating. And if they don't pay attention, they're not going to notice the results. If they pay attention and they notice the results and they have noticed the stomach ache or the sluggishness or the guilt or all the, you know, negative consequences that come with it, their brain realizes, hey, this is not as rewarding as expected. And so that's where that negative prediction error comes in, meaning it was less rewarding than expected. And that's a critical step for behavior change, because once somebody recognizes that, they're like, oh, this isn't that rewarding. Their brain moves that reward value down on what we think of as reward hierarchy, and they're less likely to do it in the future. Notice how that has nothing to do with willpower, but it has everything to do with awareness. All they have to do is pay attention. And I boil it down to this simple question, asking ourselves, what am I getting from this? Right? What am I getting from this? When I overate that, when I had that second piece of cake or that fourth cookie, what did I get from it? Ugh. And if there's some ugh there, then that's going to help us change the behavior for the future. So that's really the heart of behavior change. There's a third element there that adds to it that just builds on that same principle, which is finding what I call the bigger, better offer. And so whether it's just not overconsuming, so stepping out of the habit loop earlier, or finding, for me, I gave the example in the book of finding that blueberries actually feel and taste better to me than gummy worms. I used to be addicted to gummy worms, that it was easy to shift from gummy worms to blueberries just by remembering what the result of each one was. And same principle, finding these prediction errors and helping our brain see which is more rewarding makes it much easier to change our behavior. So shifting out of things like stress eating, overeating, and into stopping when we're full and eating healthier foods naturally, right? Not out of willpower, not because we read some blog that we should eat blueberries. That's all up in our heads. This is really about relying on the wisdom of our feeling bodies. And the way I think about that is our feeling body is much stronger than our thinking brain, right? Feeling body much stronger than the thinking brain. If we just feel into our experience, it's going to tell us everything that we need to know.
Yes, I love that, Dr. Judd. And I think it's so important to also move away from these punishing models that underlie this. All you just need is willpower. This is very yesteryear, oftentimes also tied to religiosity, right? Yeah. And it's very punishing. It's not helpful. When you mentioned the overeating habit, that's something I actually know very well. I have always been blessed with a very high metabolism, which is why I never saw physically the effects of the overeating habit that I had. Ever since I was a little girl, I realized in later years and just being on this mission of self-growth, healing, biohacking, that I was literally trying to fill a void. And what helped me massively was literally, and I did not even know about what you are sharing, what you are putting forth, it was just really becoming aware of how I feel after. Oh, it's miserable. And I think a lot to really reconnect with our feeling body again. So many of us have been disconnected and feelings, and of course, also emotions. We live in a culture where that oftentimes gets shamed. So we completely connect in it. We are so much in our heads that we don't feel ourselves anymore. And when we start feeling ourselves again and really mindfully do, I find it fascinating. You said it takes individuals 10 times and then they can basically move away from, transcend from, for example, this overeating habit. Mm-hmm. That fascinates me. Something else that really also resonated with me in your book was you actually talk about why diets don't work.
Yeah.
What, Dr. Judd, do you believe is the missing link in the traditional dieting approaches, whatever they may be?
Yes, there are a number of, let's just say, concerns that I have with the traditional dieting industry. And we can go just as far as looking to see how well they work, right? Has there been a diet that has outcompeted the others? If you take a Darwinian perspective, there's a new diet probably every 6 months. So if you look at the half-life of a diet program, it's pretty short. it's going to decay. So it's not about some special, like eating only this and not that type of thing, especially when you try to individualize it. We're such individual beings that a general diet isn't gonna nail it for each individual. When we look at, so that's one piece. Another is that when you look at food tracking, the typical food tracking apps and whatnot are notoriously terrible. They're not accurate. And they're also, on top of that, very good at pulling us out of our own experience. And people, our human brain really loves certainty. And we're learning, unfortunately, we're getting trained more and more by things that give us quantification in number of likes or number of numbers in general, to believe the numbers over our own experience. And that's really dangerous, especially when the numbers are not accurate. We just assume, oh, because the app told me I ate this number of calories, it must be true. Sorry to break the news, but everybody's metabolism is slightly different, and it depends on a whole bunch of things. And being able to track, it's just a mess. But the most important thing is that when you look at a list and it says, oh, you can consume this number of calories for the rest of the day, we're much less likely to listen to our bodies and ask, am I actually hungry? Do I need this? It says I haven't had enough protein. When we learn to listen to our bodies, are amazingly good at saying, hey, you need this. And it comes in, you know, it comes in the form of all sorts of interesting food cravings where our bodies know, hey, this kind of food is what I need right now. So the more we divorce ourselves from that experience of our own bodies by relying on these trackers and these diet programs that tell us what to do, the harder it's going to be to actually remember and retrain ourselves to listen to our own bodies. It just repeats itself over and over when people get excited. Oh, here's this new diet. They're going for the excitement of different, as compared to just doing the work and listening to their bodies. And it's every time somebody starts re-listening and reconnecting with their body, they're grateful, because it, like, when we become reconnected with ourselves, it comes with all these side benefits of doing this as compared to taking the latest drug, like these GLP-1 drugs that are all the craze, where it's like, oh yeah, I've lost weight and I feel nauseated and I don't feel like eating and all this. And it's, wow, that doesn't sound very good. But societally, they would prefer, and I've seen this in my patients and I've heard about this, and I'm sure it's individual for everyone, where people would prefer to make suffer through the side effects of these drugs, which are contributing to the weight loss, because there's such high societal benefits from looking a certain way. And so that's also something, as a society, we need to learn to step back from and ask ourselves, hey, is this really optimizing our well-being?
Yes, I agree with you, Dr. Judd. There's certain people for whom some of these drugs may be appropriate for a short amount of time, but I see it, especially here in Los Angeles, how pervasive it is. And people who, from a medical viewpoint, highly likely, definitely actually do not need them, and then go through their days and are miserable. Mm-hmm. So also this getting to a specific weight, body shape, self-perception is attached to, oh, it needs to be painful. And I think in a way our culture is also addicted to pain. You look at what gets glorified in movies or in stories, most often it's somehow tied to pain. People going through terrible physical or emotional pain, war, conflict, drama. And I think the ratio of pain versus pleasure and people just being happy and excited and connected to themselves, the pain ratio is much higher.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And just to riff on that for a second, in Hollywood, my guess is, to sell a movie, you can't end on that painful note. It's got to be that hero's journey where somebody goes through this painful process and then there are rainbows and unicorns at the end, where whatever it is that they were suffering for, they've gotten it. So there, I would say there's that. I agree with you. We love that hero's journey story. And at the same time, if you look at what we're doing every day, I would suggest that there's a lot of avoidance of pain whether we are finding more and more ways to numb ourselves from our physical and our emotional experience, whether it's painkillers or psychiatric medications that numb us out from our moods or whatnot. And I'm not suggesting as a psychiatrist, some people really need medications that are very helpful for them. So I'm not anti-medication, but if we look at how we're being trained as a society, even social media and our phones, Cornel West named, he has a great term for them, are weapons of mass distraction, right? Because we are training as a society, we're unlearning how to tolerate distress, whether it's momentary emotional distress or a mood or whatnot. Somebody's going to sell us something that's going to say, hey, you don't have to suffer through that. Just take this or do this or go on my website or watch this TikTok video or whatever. So I think it's really important that we name that, because the more and more we are trained away from distress tolerance, the harder it's going to be to want to see the benefit of learning to tolerate distress. And the easier it is for somebody to sell us something that promises us relief from the inevitable distress that's going to be there on a daily basis.
So true, Dr. Judd. And thank you for illuminating this other side of the coin. And this is something for hopefully a follow-up and another conversation, because in one of your books, you focused on anxiety. That's something I personally am. I'm an expert in anxiety because I used to have a lot of it. So yeah, that's definitely a conversation I would welcome at another point. And I'm very familiar also with the desire and also the follow through of just numbing unpleasant emotions. I've been in that loop for quite some time, looking at the different phases of my adult life. We have pain on one side, and then we have pleasure on the other. You talk about this concept of pleasure plateaus, and that's intriguing and also sounds counterintuitive. Can you explain this to us, Dr. Judd?
Yeah. And it's counterintuitive until we look at our own experience and see that we've all experienced this. And then it seems somewhat obvious. So the way I think of this is, we can think of before we've eaten a meal and we're very hungry, we can take whatever the meal is and take that first bite and notice how delicious that first bite is going to be, right? Or it's going to taste better than the last bite of the meal. And the way that works is that those hunger signals are going to affect how pleasurable food tastes and feels to us. So the more we eat and start to fill up and get those satiety cues, the more our body starts to turn on these natural mechanisms that say, hey, slow down, and then stop because you've had enough. We have satiety cues that even come in the form of food not tasting the same. This very same food not tasting the same as when we've eaten a lot of it. And one of my friends, her name is Dana Small. She's a PhD and a food researcher at Yale. She did this very elegant study for her PhD I wrote about in The Hunger Habit. I think I even wrote a little bit about it in the Unwinding Anxiety book because it's such a fascinating experiment. But basically, she just fed people chocolate, their favorite chocolate. At first, they rated it as delicious. And then by the 60th square or whatever, wherever somebody hit their way over threshold, they're rating it as disgusting. It's the same chocolate. And so the way I think about that pragmatically is, we can pay attention and notice when we're still going up on the pleasure plateau. It's like still good, still not as good. Okay, definitely not as good. We've hit that plateau, which helps us naturally stop as long as we're paying attention. If we don't pay attention, we go over the cliff of overindulgence, right? And that's where we hit that pit of regret when our stomach is like, oh, why'd you do that? And all of that. We can certainly still learn from the overindulgence piece as long as we're willing to lean into that and ask, wow, was that really worth it? What did I get from that? So we can certainly learn from it. But it helps us see very clearly that our bodies, again, they're so wise. They tell us everything that we need to know as long as we pay attention. So that's what the pleasure plateau is. And it's really there as a pragmatic tool for us to start to see how good our body is at telling us when to stop.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Thank you for explaining that, Dr. Judd. And there's something else I think will really be of value to those who are listening to us right now. The acronym RAIN, R-A-I-N, stands out in your book. And you actually have a chapter, RAIN on the Craving Monsters Parade. Can you explain what RAIN stands for and how this technique works and its benefits?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So this was a technique that was originally developed, I think, by a Western meditation teacher, Michelle McDonald, and then popularized by a teacher and a psychologist, Tara Brach. She's done such great work with this. The idea is this acronym starts with R, recognize. So we have to recognize whatever it is. So whether it's an emotion or a craving, the A stands for allow. So we have to allow ourselves to actually feel it. If we distance ourselves from ourselves, it's going to be hard to work with ourselves. Makes sense. The I stands for investigate. And I think of this is where we turbocharge our inherent superpower of curiosity. So instead of saying, oh no, I have this craving, I have to fight it. If we fight the craving monster, it only gets bigger and eventually it's going to win and it's going to eat us up. So here we can flip that. Oh no, here's this craving to, oh, what does this craving feel like in my body? And then we can, I use the word note. This comes from a Burmese tradition. Mahasi Sayadaw was the teacher that first popularized this. But the idea is we can note our physical sensations, our thoughts, and our emotions from moment to moment. And what that helps us do is see that we are not our cravings. These are sensations, these are thoughts, these are emotions that come and go. And as we start to see that, we have this space to see, I'm not my craving. It's going to come and go. And it empowers us. It goes back to what you said earlier. It empowers us to be with these sensations, watch them come and go, instead of being consumed by them or fight or resisting them. What we resist persists. And then the rest of that is what we allow ourselves to feel heals. So we learn, oh, cravings, they come and go. They're not as bad as we think. I even had a patient who came in to my office and said, hey, doc, I feel like my head's going to explode if I don't smoke. That's how strong his craving was. And we literally walked through that exercise and helped him see that these were physical sensations. He probably wrote out his first craving ever where he didn't smoke. And it just illuminated so much for him and empowered him. He walked out of my office realizing, oh, I have a lot more power than I thought. And this noting, this RAIN exercise empowers all of us to be able to be with our experience and to relate to it differently.
Beautiful. Dr. Judd, my pleasure plateau in conversation with you has certainly not been reached. So I hope we'll get another opportunity to talk more also about, particularly about anxiety. And for people who would like to learn more about you, would like to find you, and also would like to know more about your offerings, because you have all kinds of different things that you offer, your brilliant books aside, how can they do, where can they find you, and what else can they find?
Yes. So I have a website. It's just drjudd.com, drjudd.com. We've got a bunch of free resources. I love putting together short animations that highlight the neuroscience of how our brains change. And so there's a bunch of stuff there. We've done a lot of work for physician burnout in particular. So any physicians that are feeling stressed or burnt out, we've got some free resources and educational resources for them. As you mentioned, you've written a couple of books and we've got some apps that the books are based on this, that where we've done all the science behind them. And so all those materials are on my drjudd.com website.
Super. I'll make sure to also mention all of those in the show notes. Dr. Judd, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Hey, everyone. If you're as passionate about transforming your life and reaching your peak performance as I am, I invite you to join my newsletter. Think of it as your weekly dose of inspiration and knowledge to supercharge your journey to becoming superhuman. Start optimizing mentally, physically, and spiritually today. Just head over to superhumanize.com/newsletter and sign up. Trust me, your future self will thank you.